When you look behind the walls of this nation's prisons, you will see that the vast majority of prisoners are there for nonviolent crimes. This is especially true in the case of women. Welcome to the special edition of Hearsay on CKUT 90.3 FM, looking at women behind bars across Canada. This is a special one-hour edition, a collage of the voices that we have heard over the last 4 weeks. On tonight's episode, you'll hear from Kim Pate with the Association for Elizabeth Fry Societies, who's been a prison abolitionist and prisoner ally for 20 years. You'll also hear from Phyllis Iverson, who is a community and prison activist based in Vancouver, BC. She's been a prison abolitionist for 21 years. And in this hour, we'll have an overview of the prison industrial complex by author and activist Angela Davis. Stay tuned. In 1976, as today, women represent a small portion of this country's prison population. It is for this reason that the needs of women in prison have been overlooked, especially in the area of meaningful treatment and programs, and this lack of support continues right through the post-release needs as well. Historically, the programs available to women in prisons have been based on the programs developed for incarcerated men. When we look at women's crimes, we find that the types of offenses committed by women reflect the social and economic standing of women in our society. 75% of women serving time are there for minor offenses, like shoplifting, fraud, or drug and alcohol offenses. When we examine the needs of women in prison, we see that they reflect the same needs as those women in the community. 35 of provincially and 48% of federally sentenced women have a grade 9 education or lower. 40% have been classified as illiterate. The majority of women doing time were unemployed at the time of their arrest. 2/3 of all the federally sentenced women are single mothers. For many of these women, incarceration means losing their children to social services and then having to try and regain custody upon their release. 72% of provincially and 82% of federally sentenced women have histories of physical or sexual abuse. In terms of violent offenses committed by women, 62% of these charges are for low-level or common assault. There are currently 64 women serving life sentences for murder. Most women doing time for violent offenses committed their crimes against a spouse or a partner, and they are likely to have reported being sexually or physically abused, often by the person they assaulted. Until recently, there was only one prison for federally sentenced women. So if convicted and sentenced for a period of more than 2 years, women would be sent to a maximum security prison for women in Kingston, Ontario. For many women, this meant total isolation from family, friends, and community. The lack of relevant programs and the isolation of these women from their home communities amounted to torture for many women being sent there. The incidence of self-mutilation in prisons is twice the rate of that in society, and even more prevalent within the women's prisons, especially during times of stress. Slashing is seen as a serious disciplinary offense within the prison system and often leads to time in the hole. Although suicide is not as common amongst women prisoners as it is amongst men, Between December 1988 and the spring of 1992, 7 women took their own lives at the federal prison in Kingston. 6 of these women were First Nations. The 7th was the first woman in Canada to be classified as a dangerous offender. Since the 1990s, there have been 5 new prisons for women constructed in Canada. Since the building of these new prisons, we have witnessed increasing incarceration rates among women, even though the country's crime rate has been in steady decline for the past 7 years. This information has been excerpted from a History of Prisoner Justice Day available on the World Wide Web at vcn.bc.ca/August 10th. That's vcn.bc.ca/August 10th. For a general overview of women in prison and their specific issues, why they are there, and their needs, we talked to Kim Pate, who for 11 years has been working with the Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies at their head office. She has, for 20 years, worked around prison issues as a prisoner ally and abolitionist. At the Elizabeth Fry Societies, Kim Pate works on law and policy reform issues, focusing on getting women back into the community, lessening the force of mandatory sentencing laws, and eliminating forced strip searches for women in prison. We asked Kim to provide us a general overview of the situation of women in Canadian prisons.
Overwhelmingly, what we're seeing is that women in prison are the fastest growing prison population worldwide. And in Canada, there's no difference, even though we're seen as one of the most quote-unquote progressive correctional regimes in the world. The reality is, as one woman recently said when we were visiting the Okemoochee Healing Lodge out west, she said, "Everybody says this is the best prison in the world, and I guess that's true." And my response, and the response of some women from Australia who were there with me, was that the best prison in the world is no prison. And so I think that a lot of our work is really around trying to debunk some of what the mythology that's created out there. So right now, for instance, we know that as we've seen the evisceration, as we've seen cutbacks to social programs, health programs, as we've seen increased marginalization of many people, particularly racialized, poor women, those with disabilities, those who are not living in heterosexual relationships, on and on, what we know is that the discrimination that's layered upon those individuals is exponentially experienced when, if they have more than one, more than one layer of discrimination placed upon them, and increasingly they're more likely to not only be marginalized but also to be criminalized, and that's especially true for women. And so we're working on how to not only look at the conditions of confinement those women are placed under, but for instance, when we talk about health, for instance. Of course, it's a very real issue that health care needs to be adequate for all women. When we look at women who are imprisoned, whether it's at the federal, provincial, or municipal level, what we know is that progressive trends of the past to deinstitutionalize women with cognitive and mental disabilities, if I say women, it impacts men and young people as well, but women have historically been overrepresented in those in psychiatric institutions. And what we know is, as we've seen progressive trends really interfered with by the deficit dementia of the last decade or two, what we're seeing is increased numbers of women going into prison being criminalized for basically because of cognitive and mental disabilities, behavior that in the past would have never been deemed as criminal but might have been seen as a symptom or a component of another label, albeit a label that we wouldn't either accept, but would have been seen as a component of either a mental disability or a cognitive disability, as opposed to something that was indicative of a criminal behavior. what we're seeing, for instance, is women who previously may have been on the street might get upset, emotional, may now be seen as disturbing the peace, or if they grab some food from somebody, they might be charged with theft. If they grab money from someone who has or is perceived as having harassed someone for money when they're asking for money on the street, all of those sorts of things can lead to criminal charges. And what we know is once they're in the criminal justice or injustice system, they very quickly escalate through the system and end up being caught in one of the deepest, widest, stickiest nets of social control that we have. So we start seeing women going into the prison system, going into the criminal justice system, largely because of their disabilities. Then once they're in there, they become labeled as some of the most difficult to manage because they're dealing with guards or police officers who don't know quite what to do with them, who, if they're yelling and screaming, or if they're spitting, if they're crying, if they're gouging themselves, if they're attempting to kill themselves, are seen as very difficult to manage, and so many of them end up being labeled as having what's termed euphemistically as high institutional adjustment, i.e. high institutional maladjustment, as is probably the healthiest response anybody can have, but their maladjustment or their inability or unwillingness or both to adapt to the prison environment means that they end up being, instead of it being recognized as an important survival technique, they end up being labeled as requiring some of the highest security and end up being held in some of the most isolating circumstances. And then, you know, paradoxically, they end up becoming more and more entrenched in their first incident, the first issues that they may have come in with, their any mental health concerns they genuinely had, tend to be exacerbated by the prison experience because they end up being held in segregation usually. And, you know, perfect example is a woman who we're trying to get out of a segregated unit right now, who was put into maximum security after she attempted suicide because the argument went or goes from corrections that because she attempted suicide, she was, her institution, her mental health issues became so high or so great that she couldn't be managed in the regular prison environment. So they had to, so her institutional adjustment became too high to manage. So they jacked her up to maximum security status so that they then involuntarily transferred her out of the women's prison into a segregated maximum security unit in the men's prison. And even though there, the psychiatrist who saw her decided that she was no longer suicidal, was not in need of that intense psychiatric intervention, she had already been transferred, and so now we're in the fight to have her security classification reduced back to the lower security level so that she can return to the women's prison. So it's that kind of incident that is one piece of it. Another piece is we know that as we see the increased feminization of poverty, we're seeing the increased criminalization of poverty, and particularly for racialized women, and most particularly in this country for Aboriginal women. So again, women who have often experienced through the history of colonization decades, centuries of being institutionalized, first in often training schools, residential schools, and child welfare settings, juvenile custody, then into adult custody, provincial, municipal, provincial, federal. Many of those women, the entire manner in which they've managed to survive is to resist. Their resistance, however, causes them to be seen as, again, more difficult to manage. So we have a situation where at any one time, approximately half, sometimes more, sometimes just slightly fewer than half of the women classified as maximum security are women who are Aboriginal women. And what we're seeing there is that increasing numbers of women coming in who are deemed to be dangerous, are deemed to be risky, who many of them are essentially there because they have no other means to support themselves, but that they are charged with incidents that are really related to their poverty, really related to their attempt to survive, often on the street. So in a context where you might not otherwise see someone charged, if you're poor, if you're racialized, particular, and if you're young, poor, and racialized, you're even more likely to end up in prison. So we see things like women who are selling their bodies at the end of the month to make the rent or to put food on the table for themselves and or their children, ending not being paid, demanding their money, maybe, and particularly if they're Aboriginal, are likely to be charged with robbery or armed robbery if they demand their money. And if the person who's had a sex act, ostensibly in exchange for money, who hasn't provided the money, says that this Aboriginal woman was trying to rob him, chances are he'll be believed, she'll be charged, and not unlikely that she may end up in prison as a result. So we're seeing those sorts of incidents. We're seeing situations like the horrendous and tragic results of house arrest being used for welfare fraud. The whole idea that we have criminally low welfare rates in this country, and so we're seeing, I would argue that nowhere in this country can people survive on welfare, on the rates that are being provided, yet if they are caught receiving money from other ways, whether it's through, as in Kimberly Rogers' case, student loan money so that she could pay her tuition and books and obtain an education in the hopes of being able to obtain employment, or whether it's someone paying the rent when they run out of money, or whether it's prostituting themselves, or being paid under the table, on and on and on, they're likely to be, they're more likely to be charged with and convicted of the euphemism of welfare fraud. It's interesting that we don't similarly go after people who are seen as evading taxes. We don't even use the same language when we talk about people who don't pay taxes, for instance. And so I think we're seeing those trends as well. We're also seeing the backlash to years and decades of feminist work to deal with women's equality. As we've seen for many years, the rallying cry was to at least, demand that police come when they're called, when women are being raped and battered. And the result have been zero tolerance policies that have really resulted in not a gendered response, but a gendered response, but not the gendered response that was hoped for. And that is that we're seeing increasingly women being countercharged when they call the police if there have been any defensive responses made or any kind of reactions to violence. Not unlikely that they'll be charged with assault and worse in situations where women have defended themselves and their children, their lives. We've seen many women end up being charged with murder and found guilty of manslaughter in circumstances where really it should have been recognized that they were defending their lives. So we're seeing those sorts of trends increasingly happening, and the result, of course, is that we see increased numbers of women in prison, increased crowding, we see increased challenges to the resources, and as we're seeing increased concerns around, for instance, issues of women who really are in need of a great deal of personal and humane support, particularly if they've had years of abuse and sexual and or physical abuse and are dealing with the mental trauma of that. Sticking them in isolation in a prison cell is not in any way conducive to providing the support or assisting them in any manner. And in fact, the pretext that it's done for their protection or for the protection of communities as a whole is not just laughable. It's cynical, and I think it's outrageous that it's done in our name.
The Elizabeth Fry Society has a website and contact information. You had mentioned that there were 24 different local societies. Maybe you could just give the website and contact information for the national office if folks want to get involved and kind of respond in their action on these issues that we've been talking about.
That would be great. Our phone number is 1-800-637-4606. We also take calls from prisons, 613-238-2422. And our website is www.elizabethfry.ca.
Kim Pate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Gretchen.
Big day has come, bell is sounding. I run my hands one last time outside the prison walls. Town is gathering, people are trading crime for crime. Everyone needs to see that prisoner. They need to make it even easier by seeing me as a symbol, not a human being. That way they can kill me, say it's not murder, it's a metaphor. We are killing off our own failure and starting clean.
We turn now to author and activist Angela Davis. In 1969, Angela Davis was removed from her teaching position at the University of California in L.A. because of her membership in the Communist Party. In 1970, she was placed on the Federal Bureau of Investigations, or FBI's, 10 Most Wanted list, and was the subject of intense police searches, culminating in one of the most publicized trials in recent U.S. history. After a 16-month incarceration, Davis was acquitted. In 1998, she helped organize a national conference at the University of California in Berkeley called Critical Resistance Beyond the Prison Industrial Complex, which is the focus of her current scholarship and activism. Angela is the author of many books, including The Angela Davis Reader, Angela Davis, an Autobiography, Women, Culture, and Politics. We turn now to Angela Davis speaking at the ICOPA conference held in Toronto in 2001.
Well, thank you very much for the wonderful welcome. I have to say that since I just arrived last night, it is about 7 o'clock in the morning for me, so I'm trying to generate some energy in order to participate in this panel on the prison industrial complex here at the 9th ICOPA conference. And I guess I'll begin by saying that when we organized the Berkeley conference, Critical Resistance Beyond the Prison Industrial Complex, and there are some of the members of the organizing committee here in the audience today and participating in the ICOPA conference. We chose to foreground the economic, political, and ideological linkages that make the punishment industry so central to the contemporary social landscape. We very consciously chose to use the term prison industrial complex. Mike Davis had first employed it to describe the impact of the massive prison building project in the state of California on local and state economies. We chose to use this term because we thought it would assist us to further the conversation about the abolition of prison. We wanted to help shift the larger conversation from a focus on the need for prisons as the only way to create safety and security in the social environment. And of course, this has a powerful ideological appeal, the notion that prisons keep people safe in the free world. To shift from that position to a focus on the political economy of punishment, the culture of prison, and especially the ways in which prison expansion relies on racism, structural racism, ideological racism, as a foundation for colossal profits. And in this way, we hoped to begin to make abolitionism as a political project something that could be taken more seriously in the U.S. and, of course, throughout the world. Now, we can say two years, 3 years after we began to organize that conference that although the expansion of the U.S. prison system currently shows no signs of abating, the public discourse on prisons is not so overwhelmingly conservative as it was a few years ago. And this is a small victory. The term prison industrial complex, for example, which was very sparsely used a couple of years ago, now has a currency that should give us some hope that radical movements can still make a difference. And I say this because many people during this era have a tendency to feel powerless, that no matter what we do, we can't really have an impact on this system. The ideological critique that is central to our organizing work, it's not all about preaching to the choir, although as my comrade Dorsey Nunn would say, if we don't preach to the choir, then the choir itself will disappear. The experiment in incarceration that many people have written about, Mark Maurer, Eliot Curie, and others, is an incomparable kind of experiment. I think it was Eliot Curie who said that there is no social experiment of comparable magnitude outside of preparations for war. And of course, the common sense explanation is that increasing numbers of prisons are needed, and ever larger numbers of people need to be herded into these prisons in order to reduce the threat of crime. And of course, the dominant media's representational practices and conventional political discourse attempt to persuade people that the more people are put away into prisons, the safer the free world, the safer the neighborhoods, the safer the home. And we know, of course, that Hitler persuaded many people in Germany 60 years ago that the more Jews confined in concentration camps, the less threat to society, the less threat to das Volk. Here in North America, Japanese people in internment camps meant, according to the prevailing discourse, a safer world for those who remain silent about the imprisonment of Japanese people. On the one hand, it's absolutely disheartening to think that so many people can accept the twisted notion that incarceration creates security. But there are so many historical experiments in incarceration that have been accepted without question. The confinement of native peoples on reservations, the boarding school program that involved the kidnapping of indigenous people from their families and homes in order to coercively impose what was known as civilization upon them. People don't necessarily like to question that which appears to be a source of collective emotional security, especially when it is racism that gives them a sense of false security because it identifies the wrong enemy. But we can't resign ourselves to the fact that it is impossible to effectively challenge these ideologies. We have to believe that there is a way to articulate a framework within which people can critically think about our own complicity in the expansion of the prison system, our own complicity with a massive racist project. So first of all, I think we have to admit that those things about which it is most difficult to be critical are precisely those things we most take for granted, right? Those things that seem natural. And for many people, even people who espouse liberal and even progressive positions, racism is still very natural. It's still very much a part of the economic, political, and psychic structures of society. This means, of course, that the anti-prison movement, the abolitionist movement, has to be very much an anti-racist movement. And of course, the campaign against the prison industrial complex is necessarily a campaign against the expanding role of perhaps an even more virulent version of racism, which is camouflaged by the notion of a colorblind justice. All over the world, even in countries where the majority population is white, you will discover a disproportionate number of people of color in prison. You know, why is it that in the US, in Canada, even in the Netherlands, a place that one does not usually think of as being populated by large numbers of people of color, you go into the prisons and who do you find? A friend of mine some years ago said she moved to San Francisco and couldn't find black people or people of color anywhere. Finally, she began to work within the jail system, and she realized that that is where you go if you want to find people of color. As a matter of fact, it has been pointed out, I think, by Vivian Stern, that the prison is the most diverse institution. If you want to talk about racial diversity, which you do not find in the universities, you find it in the prisons. With decreasing jobs for poor people, entire communities have been criminalized. Criminalization bolsters racism, racialization. Racialization in turn furthers criminalization. And in the context of a declining system of services for poor and unemployed people, surplus populations become what Niels Christie calls the raw material for the prison industry. People who have been marginalized by the legal economy. It's characteristic of the way in which police departments participate in this racist project to place increasing numbers of bodies at the disposal of the prison system, bodies of men and women whose crimes are often minor in comparison to what is done to them within the system, which isn't to minimize the horrible acts of violence committed by some people in prison, but it's to point out that the majority of people in prison are in for nonviolent crimes. And at the same time, as this conference is pointing out, we have to emphasize the systematic violence of the corporate world and the systematic violence of the prison system, which is very much connected to that corporate world. As a matter of fact, the production of this apparatus of violence yields vast profits. I'd like to quote a woman by the name of Barbara Saunders, who's in prison, who makes an observation that makes so much sense, but which I'm sure most people never think about. She says being a woman in prison is like being in a domestic violence relationship. You never know when the rules will change and you will get beaten again, psychologically or emotionally, by anyone who has power over you. And, you know, I mention this because I think it is absolutely important for people involved in the anti-violence movement to link up with the anti-prison movement. And, you know, in a sense, we can say that prison puts both men and women into subordinate relationships to violence. It sort of recapitulates structures of the domestic violence relationship. But the point I guess I want to make is the importance of thinking about this prison industrial complex, the expansion of the prisons, not as an aberration, not as a throwback to a more savage time, not as a scar that can be somehow fixed up, but rather as a very rational response, rational in terms of the rationality of capitalism, to the current conditions created by the globalization of capital. The expansion of the prison system is not an aberration. It is an integral part of a globalized socioeconomic system that uses people primarily as a means of generating profit. Social services have been dismantled all over the world under the guise of structural adjustment. Welfare programs have been disestablished under the guise of discouraging parasitical dependency. But who is dependent and who is the parasite? The prison industrial complex is a rational response to new conditions of globalization that draw upon and help to maintain racist social relations and colonial as well as neo-colonial domination of indigenous communities. Native people in the U.S., in Canada, in Hawaii, Aboriginal people in Australia, Maori people in New Zealand. In the U.S., increasing numbers of immigrants are incarcerated in INS detention centers, which is another important area of the prison industrial complex. As increasing numbers of people are turned into raw material for the prison industrial complex, people of color largely, prison bureaucracies are following the corporate strategy of diversity management. Corporations have discovered how much more effectively they operate by incorporating people of color into their hierarchies. So have prison bureaucracies. As a matter of fact, in California, where affirmative action has been abolished in education and elsewhere in government employment, the Department of Corrections, as Ruth Gilmore has pointed out, consciously seeks out people of color to do its dirty business. There are feminist groups that assume that more women in law enforcement and more women in punishment structures will humanize these structures, but actually they're having the impact of strengthening them. And the final point I want to make is how important it is for us to consider how prison culture spills beyond the walls, how our schools begin to be modeled on prisons, how we begin to behave in the free world as targets of surveillance, as very much affected by the kinds of social relations, totalitarian social relations that are encouraged by the prison. So it's not simply a question of helping those people over there. It's about safeguarding the potential for democracy. It's about safeguarding the potential for challenging capitalism. And in this respect, I just want to add on, since I'm already over time, that our campaigns to free political prisoners, such as Leonard Peltier and Mumia Abu-Jamal, are very much a critical element of this challenge to the prison industrial complex. And with that, I want to say that our movement to abolish prisons is going to have to incorporate a strong anti-racist consciousness, strong positions against male dominance and homophobia, and a more radical and complicated opposition to globalized capitalism. Thank you very much.
The judge takes his chair. He's convinced he's a genius. His morning drink gives him strength, and he considers the prisoner. Phillips stands in chains, ankles in handcuffs, completely unashamed. He smiles and tries to wave. They gave us 5 minutes alone together in a room filled with echoes. Every time I touched Phillips' hand, a guard burst in. The first time he warned me, the second time he stood in the door, the third time he threw me out. They wanted to know how I could be his sister, and where did I live, and what was my last name, and how could we be related because of the colors of our skin in this great racist colony. I watched as the full force of common law came crashing down on Philip like a tidal wave. In the Edmonton remand, in the elevators to the cells, he slipped a bony hand out of a handcuff and held his free arm in the air. Four guards stood like pillars, afraid of what he might do, so long considered a dangerous prisoner.
To conclude this special edition of Her Say, a one-hour overview of the issues of women in prison, we turn to community activism and what one woman is doing within her community to raise awareness around prison issues, but also the issue of women in prison. Phyllis Iverson has been a prison abolitionist for 21 years. She spoke with us about the issue of First Nation women's in prison and her work around raising community awareness and providing alternatives to incarceration. I asked Phyllis how she became involved around prison issues.
Started off doing prisoner support work with a group that we called formed the Native Prisoner Support Group. And that was in response to the struggle for Native religious freedom inside prison. And that was back in 1981. At the time, you know, First Nations prisoners were not allowed to practice their religion, any of their culture traditions. And, you know, with the growing movements on the outside during the 60s and 70s, there was like a real politicization of prisoners behind bars, and that struggle obviously would ensue there as well as out on the street.
Could you maybe explain for the listening audience the disproportion in the numbers of First Nations in prisons in Canada?
Basically, First Nations adults make up, you know, about 2% of the adult population in Canada. But behind bars, you know, federally and provincially, they make up about 17% of all prisoners. But then when you break that down and look at it in terms of the different provinces and stuff, in some provinces it can be up to 79% of the prison population is First Nations.
And what's some of the reasoning behind that?
Well, racism, obviously, is what I would say. It's a situation, you know, where if you're First Nations, you get picked up for something, you're more likely to go to prison than for non-First Nations people. And because if you look even at, you know, our national incarceration rate for the overall public, it's like, you know, about 151 people per 100,000 go to prison. If you're First Nations, that number jumps to 735 per 100,000. You know, if you also compare not just First Nations, but First Nations women and children, you know, our youth, that number is even higher as well. And so once a First Nations prisoner is in the system, they're less likely to receive parole. They serve more time before parole is granted. and they're more likely to have their parole revoked.
You had mentioned First Nation women and children are higher represented in Canadian prisons, but what about women in general? What are their numbers in Canadian prisons, and why are they getting there?
Well, the number of women in prison is relatively low compared to, say, men in prison, but those numbers are climbing. And I think women only make up about 9% overall of the prison population. But since prison for women closed and they've built the 5 new prisons for women across the country, the number of women who go to prison now is like increased by 200%, I think.
So prison construction is one of the fastest growing industries in Canada. So it seems that it's prisons for women that are actually being constructed.
Yeah, women and for youth. In BC, we're sort of facing an unusual situation because I think with recent announcements from the new neoliberal government that we have, they announced that they're going to be closing 8 prisons, and that's 8 provincial prisons. And one of the things that they're doing is they're closing all of the open and medium security men's prisons, and they're only going to be keeping open the maximum security. So then one of the effects that means is if you get sentenced to do prison time in this province, you're going to be doing maximum security time, which is, obviously not everybody who goes to prison is classified as a maximum security prisoner. The other thing is that they're not expanding the maximum security prisons that they have. What they're going to do is double bunk the prisoners, and that means putting, 2 or more people in a cell that was designed to hold one person. The other thing that they're talking about closing is the only women's prison here. We're not exactly sure what they're going to do with the women. The prison that we have here is the Burnaby Correctional Center for Women, and it houses both provincial prisoners and federal prisoners, but it is basically controlled by the provincial government. And so if they close that prison, then what is going to happen with the federally sentenced women? There's talk that they might be putting them into the men's prisons, which, is like a whole bag of problems itself. There's already women across this country that are in men's prisons, and it's absolutely horrible and unthinkable that this government would put women in a men's prison. Those prisons, they're virtually in isolation. They have to stay locked up in a separate unit. They don't have the programs that are available to the men prisoners. So then also what is going to happen with the provincial women? But, with Burnaby Correctional Center for Women, because I also am part of a group called Joint Effort, which is a women in prison support group. It's been going on since the late 70s and goes out to BCCW once a week and, runs workshops and programs for the prisoners. Because it holds federal women, it's already maximum security. So even, a woman doing a provincial sentence does her time in maximum security. 1/3 of the prison population there is federal prisoners, and that means that they've been sentenced to a length of 2 years or more. There's provincial prisoners, which is less than 2 years, but there's also women on remand there who haven't even been to court yet, and they're locked in maximum security.
What are some of the other women's issues that you're working on out in BC's prisons?
One of the things is basically alternatives to incarceration, and trying to see what alternatives there are. Like when you look at women's crime, it's basically nonviolent crime. The majority of women who go to prison are in for minor offenses like shoplifting, fraud, drug and alcohol offenses. And so what you have to do is question why they even need to be in prison, like what threat are they to the community. And So for women doing time in Canada, there's basically a lack of outside services.
And what are some of the services that you're trying to bring into the prisons?
Well, we make connections with, you know, women in the community and different groups to come in and do workshops and to talk. Our group is, you know, basically an independent kind of grassroots organization. We're not funded by the government or by the prisons or by the church. And we do, you know, basically all our fundraising in the community. But, you know, really what it is to make that connection with women on the outside and women on the inside so that when women get out, you know, hopefully there is some kind of support network for them. But also I think a lot of people on the outside don't understand what prison is all about or why women are in prison. Basically, when you look at it, the needs of women in prison are the same as the needs of women in the community.
In working with the community, what do you find some of the common questions are concerning women in prison?
In my experience, I think a lot of people in the community are really surprised when they find out that these women are in prison for the crimes that they are there for. You know, like for, you know, writing a bad check or, you know, shoplifting. And, I think that overall in BC, I found that the community is really supportive around the issues of prison and prison abolition.
Maybe you could expand on that as well. We had mentioned earlier that you've been a prison abolitionist for over 20 years now. What is it to be a prison abolitionist? What is the cause that you're working for?
Well, hopefully it's going to be that, you know, the prisons basically are shut down, right? Because, I mean, even when you look at the overall prison picture, the majority of people who are in prison don't need to be there. They don't pose a threat to the community. And, you know, that's not to say that there aren't some people who should and need to be isolated from the community. But we certainly don't need, you know, a $10 billion prison system to do that. And so, basically, that's our goal, you know, my goal as an abolitionist is to shut this system down, because for the most part, the prison system that we do have is being used as a means for social control, and basically it does nothing to rehabilitate the so-called offender. It does nothing to compensate the so-called victim. And basically, it is just one big monster of an industry that feeds off the people.
And it's a monstrous industry that benefits many corporate interests here in Canada?
It employs as many people as it holds as prisoners. And it has, like, its own little industry that's Corcan, you know, and they use prison labor to build, you know, all kinds of items like office furniture and stuff like that for the military and hospitals and government offices. There's also the threat of private corporations going in to the prisons and using prison labor. Just when we're looking at, you know, the closures of the prisons in BC, one of the things that we're really concerned about is that there's going to be the threat of the private prisons coming into this province to take over. You know, they've got those eight prisons, they're already built. What are they going to be doing with them?
While there is this threat of private prisons coming in, your work continues in trying to advocate for the abolition of prisons across Canada. What are some of the alternatives to incarceration that you're trying to achieve there in BC?
Changing the world. No. I mean, I say that because whenever I think of prison and prisoners and why they're in prison, then you can really see how, as a community, we don't deal with social problems, right? You know, poverty, education, racism, sexism, classism.
So the change actually has to happen in the communities in order to benefit those who are unjustly imprisoned?
Yeah, I don't think that it can happen any other way, because you can't just open the prison doors and expect that anything is going to be different, right? I think that the change has got to come from the community and from society, right? But I mean, there certainly are a number of people that you could let out right away, right? And like I said, the people who don't pose a threat to the community.
Phyllis, if folks want to tap into your experience and get involved in prison work, could you give them some contact information maybe for the groups that you're active with out there in BC?
We've got a website, and that's for the Prisoners Justice Day Committee, but it also has links on it to Joint Effort and Books to Prisoners, and that's at www.vcn.bc.ca/August10. The email is august10@vcn.bc.ca, and our phone number is area code 604-682-3269.
Well, thank you very much. Concludes the special edition of Her Say, focusing on women behind bars. You heard the voices tonight of Kim Pate with the Elizabeth Fry Society, Phyllis Iverson, community and prison activist based in Vancouver, BC, and Angela Davis, author and activist. For more information about Her Say, you can contact the CKUT Spoken Word Department at 514-398-6787, extension 2593.